You are now listening to the 13 Club Podcast. My name is Miranda, and I will be one of your hosts tonight.
And my name is Kim, and I'll also hang out. I'll be here, I guess.
She guesses. She's really not committed to the idea.
I mean, if I have time.
Do you have anything you want to talk about before we jump into our episodes for today? Our topics?
We will talk about it more at the end, but we did get a sponsor, and we're excited about that.
We did get a sponsor, and we are excited about that.
And it's actually, like, it's not like we are just shilling a product that we don't like. It's a sponsor we really like, so it's awesome.
And, like, even
we'll tell you more about that at the end.
Yeah, even better, we think you will really like it, so it's, like, win-win-win, but...
Yeah.
You can just stay tuned and find out about it.
So, my topic is suicide challenges or self-harm challenges.
Oh, boy.
And I feel the need to cover this because, once again, a new Momo clone has popped up, and I'm going to get to that at the end because I feel like there's a lot of backstory here for people who don't really understand what's going on with this,
mm-hmm.
and people who just see it in the media, and it's like can be a little scary. So I want to start with the Blue Whale Challenge, as it is kind of the basis for a lot of this. And the Blue Whale Challenge is a game whose origins are Russian and stemmed from a website called VK.com, which is a popular social media platform there in Russia. Players were to contact a moderator who would assign them 50 days of challenges. These challenges would begin simply with examples of, like, watch a horror movie or wake up at weird times, and they would progress into self-harm and ultimately suicide. Players are told in some versions of the game that their family will be harmed or that they will be tracked down once they stop playing the game. You are, quote, not allowed to leave the game. The media really went crazy with this one, and honestly, when do they not? Reports claim that over 150 teenagers committed suicide after being involved with this challenge. A few specific names were tied to the game. Rina Palenkova, Yulia Konstantinova, and Veronika Volkova were all teenagers who committed suicide and seemed to have some blue whale hints in their social media profiles. There were a few instances where teens were actually, or supposedly, rescued from the challenge, and they gave intel on what the game actually entailed, where they, like, gave a list of their, like, so challenges so far and things like that. A correspondent from Radio Free Europe created a fake account on VK.com pretending to be a 15-year-old girl. He claims to have spoken with the admin of the game, who told him several times that he would not be able to leave the challenge once it had begun, and they had all of her, as in the girl he was pretending to be anyway, info, and would come for them. A little question for me there is, like, if the admin had all of the info, wouldn't they know that it was, like, a reporter and not a teen girl? But if you know everything. But anyway, the first challenge given to the reporter was to scratch F58 into their arm, and I don't know what the significance of that is at all, and I didn't find anything about it. The RFE correspondent created a photoshopped image of this, but was never contacted again after that. Perhaps his mock-up was unconvincing, or perhaps it wasn't the real admin.
Mm-hmm.
So what tends to happen in these situations? Copycats arise. Some Sea of Whales groups popped up. One of them even said that they weren't even trying to get people to kill themselves, that they just wanted more website views. And then there were some alternate reality games, which are also known as ARGs, which are usually just like cryptic or spooky little puzzle games that the audience is expected to solve to get a story. A few of them were popped up that were based around this challenge, and there's one that's still up right now, for example, that's called The Insider Project.
Hmm.
Eventually, which is honestly a rarity in situations like these, we find that one teenage boy is responsible for creating at least the original Blue Whale Challenge. He is 17-year-old Philip Budaikin. He confessed to provoking the suicides of 17 people and said that 20 others had been contacted. According to a few sources, he had did it because he was trying to cleanse society of biological waste. He also said that he had given those people comfort and warmth, and that they died happily. So he went to jail, I think, for, like, I really wish I had written it down now, but I think he went to jail for a few years, not as long as he probably should have. When you research the challenge, a few images of self-harm pop up, including a pretty stunning self-harm piece of a whale, like a cut, whale cut into the skin. And I dug around to find where this image originally came from, and I couldn't find it. And it's posted in almost every article of the Blue Whale Challenge, including articles covering specific deaths, which is yet another example on how disingenuous news coverage across the world can be. Now, risky challenges are not new. We talked about the Chubby Bunny Challenge when I was researching this. So, like, what do you remember of the Chubby Bunny Challenge?
So, I remember being in, like, 5th or 6th grade when I remember hearing about it. I honestly did not know what it was until my mom and grandmother saw a, like, news piece about it. And they were like, if anyone ever dares you to do the Chubby Bunny Challenge, you just tell them no. And as I recall, it was like, you just like shoveled marshmallows into your mouth until you choked and then you died.
You're supposed to shovel marshmallows into your mouth and fit as many in your mouth as you could while somebody grab your cheeks like this.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, Chubby Bunny, Chubby Bunny. And then you try not to choke and die. That's mm-hmm. the challenge. And like, we both talked about this, and, like, we literally, it was a big deal to our parents, yeah. and, like, a big deal in the media, but, like, I don't know anyone who ever tried this challenge. Like, no. The only thing I know of is that, like, every time there would be, like, marshmallows at, like, s'mores time, somebody would make a Chubby Bunny joke.
Right.
You know? But, like, nobody actually ever did that.
I do also do not know anyone who ever, ever, ever actually did.
So in today's concerned society, I've heard about the Tide Pod Challenge. Which I didn't know was a challenge. Like, really? Like, I don't even know if that's true. I'm gonna say that now. I know some people ate Tide Pods. I don't know that it was ever really a challenge. There's choking challenges, and I've seen people of several age groups setting themselves on fire for challenges. And slightly less sinister, I'm sure it could go any direction the creators wanted to take it, but YouTube has these 3 a.m. challenges where they tell you to do things, like, at 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. You guessed it. Like, call God or download the Ghost Tracker app. The 3 a.m. challenge is so, like, some of it is so absolutely just bafflingly stupid. And I'm like, wow, are kids actually, and a lot of them are adults catering towards kids. And mm-hmm. it's like, you guys are getting worse at urban legends. I didn't know that was possible. You guys are literally getting worse.
Yeah, it makes the, like, trashy creepypastas of the last few years look good in comparison. Like, great. Yeah.
They are just, like, trash on fire. They are, like, such bad, low-quality clickbait. But then we also have, like, the other side of the urban legends, where we, modern, like, today's urban legends, where, you know, there's, like, the apps that are said to connect children to pedophiles or encourage them to harm themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like, haven't you heard, I don't even remember, like, a lot of examples of this, but in the Momo episode, one mother even, like, made up her own rumor to make it seem like her child had been victimized by Momo. And there was, like, no evidence of it.
Right.
And they said, like, it was a talking video where Momo was talking over a video. And we're like, Momo was a, like, one photo. Like, she wasn't talking.
Right. There's no way. Oh my god, can you imagine if someone deepfaked Momo?
Oh my god, please do it. I actually, like, don't, because the creator is, like, really bummed about it, as we talked about in the episode.
Yeah, let's not do it, but that's the only way I can imagine having a, like, talking Momo video could
possibly
work.
The other thing I could think of is if it was just her image and then somebody talked over the image.
Right. But it's still BS.
But still, she didn't have any evidence of it.
Right, exactly.
And I covered that more in the Momo episode. And then there's, like, this one that really pissed me off. Like, I was so angry, I was, like, yelling about it. But, like, the Daily Mail is, like, I would honestly suggest that you never listen to the Daily Mail and just assume that everything they ever say is false. And let me give you an example of why. According to the Daily Mail article, a 5-year-old Russian girl had severely burned herself doing the Fire Fairy Challenge. They claim that she saw a social media post based on the TV show Winx Club and that said to recite an incantation and turn on the gas on the stove and that in the morning you would be a fairy. There's a lot of emphasis on not telling your parents and being sneaky and also to not light the stove so that they don't get burned. And what she did do was take two wooden sticks and set them, she turned on the stove, she took two wooden sticks and she, like, lit them on fire, and then her clothes caught on fire, and she was burned horrifically. And did she do this for a challenge? I strongly doubt that. And please bear with me if you already know how to do this. But, like, first, let's just look on the outside of this. She's 5. And the social media post that I saw, that I looked up on the, like, the Russian social media post, was text-heavy. Okay? And then how many kids at 5 have their own social media accounts? Probably more than there should be, but not most kids, I don't think. Like, my nephew and nieces have never had their own social media accounts at 5, where they're just perusing and reading text-heavy memes.
This is no longer the Wild West of growing up on the internet.
Yeah. So what I did, because I felt like this was wrong, so I took one of her images, because in the photo, in the Daily Mail article, they use, like, some really graphic images of her burns. And I took one of those photos, and I put it through a reverse image search. And if you don't know what that is, it literally is like Googling, but Googling with an image. So I put it through a reverse image search, and I know you know how to do this, but I'm just kind of like sharing with the class. And then I sort it from like the oldest known appearance of the image on the internet. And when I did this, I found Russian news site articles, and I ran those through a translator, and they said that she had simply wanted to be a fairy after watching Winx, and in her, like, baby brain, fire seemed magical, and she was unattended by her grandmother, who was supposed to be watching her. So there was no mention of a challenge, and it is absolutely fucked that you would exploit a little girl's burn photos and try to scare people into thinking that their children are at risk of this happening to them because of the internet, and not because of negligence.
Right, exactly.
So yeah, thanks Daily Mail, you're a real one, as always. So then, using the same technique, I compared the oldest article I could find about the little girl with the oldest appearance of the meme image. Like, I found, like, the Wix one that has, like, the incantation stuff. And I translated it, because I wanted to be sure that the Daily Mail wasn't, like, completely lying about what the image said.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't. And then, I looked at the oldest appearance of it, and, like, the oldest appearance that I could find was 2 years before that girl ever got burned.
Right.
So people were, like, it was, like, an old, they connected the dots in a way that doesn't entirely make sense, just to make a salacious article.
Yeah, that definitely seems like, intentionally, abusing the facts. Like, yes, this image and this, like, challenge existed, yes, this little girl was burned under certain circumstances, but, like, you cannot just draw a line from point A to point B and say, like, here you go.
Yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and I think it's, like, absolutely wrong to use her photos and exploit her like that. So then I'd also say, like, in your internet sleuthing out there, which I think everyone should do, like, I really believe that if you see an article and it feels weird, or just in general, you need to check multiple sources. You need, if you're wondering if something is true, there are these tools out there that help you figure it out. And I feel like it's a lot of critical thinking, and sometimes it can be inconvenient, but it's necessary to get the whole story. And then the other one I would suggest using is the Wayback Machine, which you've used and talked about on the show, but it's basically, like, it takes past, like, snapshots of websites and stuff that have since been deleted, and you can go, like, pretty far back, usually, to see. It depends on how indexed the site was, but if people delete content, you can go back and see it that way.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So there are, like, more examples of this, and I'm only gonna, you know, give a couple more, but I found this one that was called Miriam Game, and if you Google it, you'll find so many people claiming that this Saudi Arabian game was translated into several it was translated into several languages, and people say that it will tell your child to self-harm, or it will steal information on how to get to your child. And although the game is a little odd, to be sure, especially with its poor translations and attempt to be a horror game, these allegations are completely false, and that is usually the case, and we really don't even know how these rumors started. I watched a gameplay on YouTube by the Gamer Turtle, and there was no evidence to support these claims, and people tried to get the rumor to continue running after he tried to debunk it by saying, the game is different on every platform.
Mm-hmm.
But it literally isn't.
Right.
Like, it's the same game. And it's just, like, it's a little weird. It's supposed to be a horror game, and it's, like, a little bit twisted, and then, like, the translations are, like, really rough. So some of the, it just feels a little strange, but there's, in the entire gameplay I watched, there was no mention of, like, giving your information or trying to kill yourself or anything like that.
Right.
It was mostly, like, a choose-your-own-adventure type, like, visual novel.
Okay, gotcha.
And like I said, there are a lot of examples here, like, a lot. Like, people like to create these ideas to scare parents and children. They, like, love to do it. And we are more or less getting into the Momo part of the timeline now, keeping in mind that there are literally too many cases of this for me to cover in one episode. But the whole Momo fiasco was basically where a Japanese horror sculpture was photographed at an art exhibit. And she's, like, a real cute spooker, if you haven't seen her. But people started using her image on social media and asking people if they wanted to participate in, like, blue whale challenge type games.
Mm-hmm.
So they were using Momo as a profile image and then going around and talking to people and just, like, being generally weird. It was on WhatsApp, it was on Instagram, it was on, like, every social media.
Yeah, basically.
And then the media went wild with it, and the Japanese artist was, like, heavily shamed, and if you're interested in his response, which I think is really good, where he denies tons of cash for movie rights and says he hates the idea of his creations being involved with hurting kids, this is the last time I'll be like, hey, listen to the Momo episode, because I did do a lot of coverage on that. And so now we got a new one, and I've seen a bunch of tweets, Reddit posts, YouTube videos on Jonathan Galindo.
Tell me all about him.
I mean, there's really not much to it. Like, this is the name used on several accounts, and it's another artist's creation, similar to Momo, that is used to spook kids and is asking them to play a blue whale-type game, and this is, like, a direct Momo clone.
Mm-hmm.
So the image, which is admittedly a horrifying special effects work that is really gross-looking, and it is a mask that was, like, the creator has even said that it was inspired by Disney's Goofy, and it just looks like, it looks awful. Like, it's really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've not even, like, looked that close at it, but I've definitely seen it floating around, and I'm like, well, no thank you.
It's just gross. Like, there's nothing graphic about it, but it's just, like, an unsettling image. An artist, visual effects and mask and other types of, like, art creator named Dusky Sam created it. And the Galindo boogeyman character originally cropped up in South America in 2017, and now it's back. Like, it never had the name Jonathan Galindo until 2017 in South America. And I'm seeing, like, mostly Instagram screenshots, and most of the people running the accounts really do seem to be trolls who can be easily deterred with jokes or a simple block. Basically, somebody was, like, they sent out, like, message requests to Dusky Sam. And the guy was like, hey man, I have some questions about your work. And the guy was like, Dusky Sam said, ask away. And he said, I'm Brazilian and some news with the title Goofy Man Encourages Suicide for Children. And I want to know if the art named Goofy Man, which is Hamem Pateta, is really one of yours. And if it's one of your works. The photo, the English is a little bit like difficult to decipher sometimes, so please forgive me on that. Dusky Sam said, the photo dates back to 2011, 2012. It's one of my earlier attempts at makeup effects. I won't lie, he was something of a troll character back then, seeing as I did the makeup for my own fun, and I was okay with it. Normally, I'm a quiet, reserved sort of guy, so he gave me the chance to sort of be stupid and ridiculous. I hadn't called the photo Goofy Man. That sounds like more of a recent thing that someone else did, but even before Galindo, the makeup circulated around 4chan and other sites looking for cringe. Believe me, that wasn't an intention of mine. And the person said, I understand you. That is a thing normal in the internet. That's like a quote I want tattooed on my body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing normal in the internet.
Yeah.
Like Momo and others. He's like, oh yeah, I'm not offended by it becoming some weird meme. However, I do hear rumors of people using it to drive young people to suicide, and that is very ugly stuff. And he was like, yeah, why do people make it like that? Who is Jonathan Galindo? Is this the name of a Facebook profile? Who make that with your Goofy? He goes, that is recent news to me. The Jonathan Galindo account dates back to the early 2017. It is a fake account and someone made using my makeup pictures and other masks I had made. I don't really know who they are, and they have gotten a lot of internet mileage off my old photos. They seem to have a mostly young Latin and South American following. Not sure that if they are actually from there or not. I'm not much of a detective. I only follow the trends I see as they happen, and only when I'm not leading a regular life. And then he said, in South America, it is new. In Brazil, at least, many parents are concerned about these things. In the end, it's just a bad management of the content that children watch, like Momo. Do you know who is Momo? I think it's another event of Latin and South America.
Momo was all over.
Yeah. the character was never meant to become a boogeyman, but is way out of my hands. I heard of Momo recently, another internet creature that has become popularized. Can I share this conversation? It would be very good to clarify some things for newspapers and others. If you'd like, sure, I have been asked a lot of questions in the past couple months. Are you the press or just curious person? Thank you very much for helping with this. They are not very important details, but I find it interesting to add to your side. Press? No, no. I'm just a programmer angry at people blaming the wrong things. And then Dusky Sam links to somebody who has recreated the Momo, it's like a silicone mask that you can wear. Somebody recreated it, and they're called Shattered Effects. And then the guy responds, here it is, the cute Momo. And Dusky Sam says, there is a lot of weirdness going on these days. 2020 has been an insane year. That Momo was made by an American mask company recently, probably trying to grab onto its recent popularity. Yeah, I think DeGoofy will receive a mask, but for Halloween. Who knows? I did ask a mask company several years ago how much to make a custom silicone version of the Goofy, and they said $4,000, and I said thank you and left it at that. I can't really claim any copyright as I will be the first to admit that Disney's Goofy was a big inspiration. I may have gone for a dirtier, grungier version, more to mock Disney than Goofy. I actually like that their creation very much. And yes, that is a lot of money. That is rent for several months, and I can't afford it. I have wanted to make a mask version of my own, but that is one of the projects that is one of many projects I come up with versus actually finishing. I feel that. Disney has good creations. Goofy is a little strange, but beauty. Disney has a sort of good part of my kid time. I have a real issue with Disney. If I have a real issue with Disney, it's their aggressive acquiring of several fantasy franchises and ruthless protection of their assets. They weren't always like that, but now they are a massive corporate entity that can crush creativity for people who want to try weird variations of their stories. I do like a lot of their films and characters, but I don't care much for their drive to own all of fantasy. Fantasy should belong to everyone. I agree. And he said, yeah, I hope you don't have problems with them. They have a great team of lawyers.
Yeah.
And then they said, I will take a bath. Thank you for the chat. If I return to my version, I will make some cosmetic changes so that it doesn't look as cartoonish. I have different stories I would like to tell them. And he says, good luck with your projects. And then he says, thank you. So there is Dusky Sam's take on it. And now, much like the Blue Whale game with the Galindo character, the administrator, if you can even call someone an administrator after sending you one DM on Instagram, that's basically like, do you want to play a game? And then they're just like, yes, no, whatever. And they're like, well, I have all of your information, so now you have to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, freaking people out. And I just wanted to sort of reassure people that as long as you've never posted your public address or information, and that you don't click any links that they send you, you will be fine. So just block that goofy boy and be done with it. Now, I'm not saying that bad people can't use these games to try to get at kids. While these seem to be mostly hoaxes, when they get sensationalized, shitty people do get attracted to them. And I really recommend not engaging at all with someone who attempts to get a conversation out of you in such a negative way. The block button is your friend, but it's really not much scarier than any random person contacting you on Instagram. Like, it's a scary mask, and they're trying to be a spooker, but it's really not scarier than just talking to any other stranger. And I shouldn't have to say this, but as your grandmother, I feel obligated to tell you that not everybody on the internet is who they appear to be.
Yeah.
And that's my story.
Thank you for that very educational, inspirational look into the history of internet challenges.
Well, I'm trying to be, like, a little bit more, accessible for everyone, because I know that not everyone spends a million hours on the internet like we do.
Yeah.
And not everybody knows the ins and outs of the horror community online.
Right.
So, like, I think about it from a perspective, like, my uncle Bernie listens to the show.
Oh, hi, Uncle Bernie.
Yeah, and I feel like he would have no idea what I'm talking about with, like, not to trash on Uncle Bernie, but, no. Like, this is not stuff he's busy doing his life. He's not, like me, a troll. He sits on the internet all day to look up creepy stuff and then make a podcast about it. Like, some of this stuff is really complex, and especially if you didn't grow up in this culture, it can be hard to decipher, especially when the news outlets are telling you that it's dangerous and children are dying and all of the children you know will die.
Right. I think there's, like, this is not an original thought by any means, but, like, the internet itself, not just, like, coding or anything, but, like, the internet itself is a different language. And you're either, you're either proficient in it or you're not.
And we're starting to lose our grasp on it because we have a new generation cropping up and they have all different slang and all different things that they're doing.
Exactly. It's constantly evolving.
That's why, like, I feel like I am a grandmother because I, like, check in with my nieces and I'm just like, hey, anything weird going on?
Right.
Let me know. My older niece Emma said she had not heard it. Like, nobody, none of her friends were talking about Galindo or anything like that. And then my niece Katie, who's 13, she said that she did know about it, but that no one had tried to contact her or anything.
Yeah. I think sometimes, obviously not in every case, but, like, sometimes these characters and situations that claim to target children, like, are actually, it's just parent bait. It's targeting parents who are scared for their children more than anything.
And for people like the Daily Mail, it's great coverage because people are gonna click those articles.
Yeah, those, you know, you see a sad photo of a child that's been hurt and gosh darn if you're not gonna click it, I guess.
Videos of that poor little, or the images of that poor little girl are, like, I have, like, welled up when I saw them. Because they are so bad.
I, at the risk of sounding like an asshole, like, I thought, wow, that's really good special effects makeup. The first time I saw that.
I know, because she's been grafted, and it looks crazy. But she's had a bunch of surgeries, I guess, and she's, like, pretty... According to the Russian media, they had, like, some little comments from her that were very cute and inspiring, where she was just like, I believe one day I will run and I will dance. Like, it's going to be, like, fine.
Right.
But, of course, like, Daily Mail didn't add those comments.
Look at this horror story. This child's life is ruined. Yeah. That's the scummiest thing, honestly.
It's so nasty. Like, it makes me so angry, and I just want people to know not to support them. If you can take one thing away from me, please don't support
If you can
Daily
find
Mail.
Any other news source.
Well, and then there were some other news sources who had sort of taken the tip from the Daily Mail, and they had posted their own. And if you go to, the Snopes article on it, the other people have already taken down their article because they know it's wrong.
Right.
But the Daily Mail persists.
Yeah, we don't fucking care.
Because people like me are still clicking on it.
Right.
I clicked on it, you know, 2 days ago and read the whole article, and that's, you know, that's traffic for them.
Exactly. Well, I hope that... I think this is a nice, like, follow-up and companion piece to your, like, Momo episode as well. I think, like, between the two, you've done some, like, really excellent research on how these kinds of challenges function, why they take off and get the kind of traction that they do, and, like, how to approach them from a, like, logical standpoint, whether as, like, a person who's being targeted by them or as, like, a concerned parent or even just, like, a member of the internet community. Like, I think you've provided, like, a really good perspective on how to approach these things.
Thank you. I really try because I really don't want you guys to get, like, upset over people who do not deserve your attention.
Absolutely.
We have too many other serious problems to be worrying about.
Yeah, there's too much going on for me to be worried about Galindo.
Yeah.
Quite honestly.
Though, props to Dusky Sam because that is, like, a really good special effects piece. Like,
yes.
It's creepy and I hate it.
As an artistic standpoint, bravo.
Yeah, I hate it in the best way. Like, good job. You are literally a boogeyman now, and I know that it sucks. Like, that's the one thing that really breaks my heart for these creators, is that I love that my work is being, like, recognized and seen. But I don't want it to be associated with trying to hurt children.
Yeah, no. I'm sure that feels awful. Because
these were all intended for... This is all intended for adults. Like... Yeah.
Damn. Well, I guess now it's my turn. So, my topic today started as a postmortem subject, and then I got deeper into it and realized that this could be a full episode in and of itself. So, now you've got that. So, if you guys remember back to episode 21, I talked about Edward Paynell, who was also known as the Beast of Jersey. He also had a very horrifying mask.
I showed it to my mom, and she was like, what movie is that?
That's real life, Mom.
Yeah. I was like, well, he's a serial rapist, and he used that to rape children. And she was like, oh my god!
True facts. But I mentioned briefly in that episode, so when they finally kind of caught up to him, and they were, like, investigating his house, and they started to, like, question him and try to get, like, information out of him, he had this, like, fascination with the occult, and specifically with a historical figure named Gilles de Rais. I'm gonna be flexing my bad high school French pronunciation.
I'm so proud of it. Like, I'm not even ever gonna try.
I'm probably saying every single word wrong, but he was really fascinated with this historical figure and, like, the occult, and at the time that I was writing about that, because my focus was on Edward Paynell and not Gilles de Rais, I was like, I will do, like, the briefest of Google searches on this guy. And the, like, consensus was that he was, like, a bad dude, and a lot of people call him, like, one of history's first serial killers. However, I dug a little bit deeper into it, and I actually became really, intrigued, because, this is a, like, a public call-out for Kim. She is a little bit of an expert in, Elizabeth Bowtry, and...
God, I wouldn't say that.
I think, you know, at some point in the future she should do an episode about that. But I got, like, real, Elizabeth Bowtry vibes from kind of how this person was treated. But he was also just, like, a very eccentric dude. So I am going to talk about, quote, history's first serial killer, Gilles de Rais.
That's so crazy because I have not heard of this. I'm excited.
It was a name that I had definitely heard before, and I was thinking to myself, why do I know that name? Why do I know that name? And I think, like, once I get to a certain point, you'll be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That might be why I've heard of that name.
Maybe I've seen it in text, but I'm not, like, hearing the pronunciation and reconciling it with how it's spelled. Anyway, continue.
Well, okay. So, Gilles de Rais was born in or around 1405. As a son of nobles in the area of Rais, part of the larger region of Brittany in France. He was a bright child. He wrote illuminating manuscripts. He spoke Latin fluently. He studied military tactics. Both his parents died in about 1415, so when he was 10 years old. His father, Guy de Laval, was killed in a gruesome hunting accident that de Rais may have witnessed. And his mother, Marie de Crayon, died of an unknown cause. He was raised by his maternal grandfather, Jean de Crayon, who was well known as a political schemer. In fact, in kind of his unending efforts to increase the family fortune, his grandfather tried marrying him off several times to rich heiresses in the region of, like, France. Including when Gilles was 12. His grandfather tried to marry him to a four-year-old, but that didn't happen, and he was eventually...
God.
Yeah. He was eventually married to Catherine de Thouars of Brittany, heiress of Le Vendée and Poitou. Their only child, Marie, was born in 1429. So, as a young man, de Rais seems to have been, like, impetuous and, like, hot-headed, which are all characteristics that translate really well to the battlefield, where he was, by all accounts, a skilled and fearless fighter. Rais got wrapped up in the massive conflict between the Kingdom of France and the Kingdom of England that would be come to be known as the Hundred Years' War, where his home region, Brittany, became a disputed territory between the two kingdoms. When Joan of Arc appeared on the scene in 1429, he was assigned by the Dauphin, who later became the King, King Charles VII, to watch over her in battle. So they were like partners. And the two fought together in some of the major battles of her short career, including lifting the siege of Orléans. So they were tight. And I think that's probably where I heard his name before, was in association with Joan of Arc.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't think I remembered his name.
He's not as cool as she is, that's all.
No.
But in 1429, he was appointed to the position of Marshal of France, which is France's highest military distinction. So, you know, this guy was tough. However, after this point in time, like 1429, 1430, he began to slowly withdraw from the military life. And there's a lot of speculation that that's because his close friend Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. So he was probably like, okay, I feel like I might not be welcome here. I'm gonna peace out.
I'm gonna read the room.
I'll see you guys next week. So he started to spend more and more time just on his estate, which at this point in time was among the richest in Western France. He spent his fortune...
Oh my god, does it still exist?
Hmm?
Does it still exist?
The region of France?
The estate?
I'm gonna say no.
Okay, bummer. Anyway.
Because he spent his fortune extremely recklessly.
Oh, okay.
He paid enormous sums for decorations and servants and a large military retinue and commissioning music and works of literature. One really big example that people like to reference was this theatrical spectacle that he attended to put on that was called Le Mystère du Siège d'Orléans. The play consisted of more than 20,000 lines of verse requiring 140 speaking parts and 500 extras. And he started selling off nearly all of his estates to fund it. Half the total sales and mortgages of selling off his estate and stuff was spent on the production of his play. It was finally performed for the first time in Orléans on May 8th of 1435. 600 costumes were constructed, worn once, discarded, and constructed afresh for subsequent performances. So that is the level of, like, wastefulness that we're seeing here.
Also, I bet it sucked. I bet it sucked ass.
What, the play?
Yeah.
It probably, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like the more money you suck into something like that, then, like, somehow the quality gets less good.
I'm gonna spend a whole bunch of money on... It's like me when I'm like, trying to fix a prop that I've made for cosplay. I'm just like, if I just put enough coat of paint on this, it's gonna be fine. But it's not.
It's just not. It's never as good.
You need a strong foundation.
So also at these performances, unlimited supplies of food and drink were made available to the audience at his expense.
The most epic of open bars.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, his family was not thrilled with this. And his lifestyle, his extravagant lifestyle, sparked a bitter fight with other members of his family, especially that maternal grandfather that raised him, Jean de Crayon, who very pointedly left his sword and armor to Gilles' younger brother, René, when he died in 1432. So Grandpa was like, fuck you, I'm going to leave the sword and shield to your brother. You know, the military genius? Goodbye.
Stung a bit.
I imagine it hurt. So, like, his family went so far as to appeal to both the Pope and the King to take some kind of measure against their entire family's ruination at the hand of Gilles and his follies. And the Pope refused to get involved. But, the King, which, again, this is still King Charles VII, so this is someone who, the person who assigned Gilles to watch over Joan, and who awarded him all these lavish military honors and really, like, rewarded him for his, like, bravery during the war. I assume he felt some kind of pity for him and pity for his family. So he issued a royal edict announcing him as a spendthrift and forbidding him to sell any more property. No subject of Charles VII was allowed to enter into any contact with him, and those in command of his castles were forbidden to dispose of them. Ray's credit fell immediately, and his creditors pressed upon him. He borrowed heavily, using his art, manuscripts, books, and clothing as security. And he finally left Orléans in late August or early September of 1435. And it said the town was littered with precious objects he was forced to leave behind. However, the king's edict did not apply to Brittany, so, and, like, the family was unable to persuade the Duke of Brittany to enforce it, so I guess he was free to go back to Brittany or make deals with Brittany and try to, like, get some kind of wealth back.
Just imagining, like, a really rad yard sale.
I know, right? There's, like, suits of armor everywhere and, like, gold bars.
Priceless painting.
Can you imagine? So, in later years, Drey seems to have been increasingly concerned with religion and, like, his own salvation. So, in 1433, so this is kind of before the, like, the downfall, but he's still spending too much, he financed the construction of a chapel for the bliss of his soul, which he called the Chapel of the Holy Innocents, which was staffed with a boys' choir selected by himself personally. But he also didn't solely rely on religion, like, organized religion. He also kind of investigated the occult as a means to save his rapidly collapsing finances, employing a succession of alchemists and sorcerers. Hey, man. Sometimes you gotta grow a little mint, burn a little paper. For example, in 1438, according to testimony at his trial, which we'll get to the trial soon, that testimony at his trial by the priest Eustache Blanchet and the cleric François Prelati, Reyes sent out Blanchet to seek individuals who knew alchemy and demon summoning. Blanchet contacted Prelati in Florence and persuaded him to take service with his master Drey. Having reviewed the magical books of Prelati and traveling to Brayton, Rey chose to initiate experiments. The first in the lower hall of his castle, attempting to summon a demon named Baron. Drey provided a contract with the demon for riches that Prelati was to give the demon later. And my first thought was, like, you're gonna promise this demon riches when you have nothing? Like,
yeah,
he's gonna know. You can't pull one over on... But I digress. So no demon manifested after three tries, probably because he knew you were broke. So the marshal grew frustrated with the lack of results. Prelati said Baron was angry and required the offering of parts of a child. So Drey is said to have provided these remnants in a glass vessel at a future evocation, but it still didn't work, and the occult experiments left him bitter and his wealth severely depleted. So we're gonna jump forward a few-
Where do you get the child from?
You can't see my face, but we're gonna jump forward a few years. So,
okay.
We're gonna hit 1440. And Drey has an argument with a cleric at the Church of Saint-Étienne de Mermoz, which resulted in him straight up kidnapping the priest. I do not know what they had an argument about, but whatever it was, Drey was not gonna let it go. So, the church, under the Bishop of Nantes, then launched an investigation into this kidnapping and found that over the previous 8 years, Drey had been engaging in some of the most heinous acts imaginable. While this has all been going on, meanwhile, rumors had begun to circulate. Children had gone missing in the areas around Drey's castles, and many of the disappearances seemed to be connected to the activities of Drey and his servants. Because it was common for young boys to be permanently separated from their parents if they were taken on by nobles as servants or pages, some of his victims' parents would have been truly unaware of their children's fates. In other areas, though, perhaps Drey's murderous predilections may have been something of an open secret, but the families of the victims were restrained by fear and low social status from actually doing anything about it.
God, can you imagine living in that time where it's just like, a rich man stole my child, and I'm pretty sure he killed him, but I can do fucking nothing.
I don't know, man. Doesn't sound so different from today.
Yeah. I mean...
Look. Like I said, kidnapping a priest means that a bishop is gonna show up and start investigating you. And actually, kind of like, I guess to their credit, there were multiple investigations done, so there was a religious investigation done by the church, formal, and then they did a secular investigation that was totally separate from the church, and they kind of put their findings together, and they found that their evidence was, like, corroborative, and Guilderoy and the two servants were arrested under charges that included murder, sodomy, and heresy. So here's the part where it gets a little bit gross, and if you aren't comfortable with hearing about bad things happening to kids, maybe like skip forward a minute or two. Otherwise, buckle up. So, under the threat of torture, and I think it's important, it's always important to note when someone is confessing under the threat of torture. But under the threat of torture, De Rey and company confessed, and in his confession, Rey said he committed his first assaults on children between the spring of 1432 and 1433. The first murders occurred at Champtocé-sur-Loire, but no account of them survived. Shortly after, De Rey moved to Machecoul, where, according to his confession, he killed or ordered to be killed a large but uncertain number of children after he sodomized them. The first documented, so like actually something is written down, or there's some way to, something that documents it. The first documented case of child snatching and murder concerns a boy of 12 called Jeudon. His first name is unknown. He was an apprentice to the furrier Guillaume Hilliare. Drey's cousins, Gilles de Sille and Roger de Briqueville, asked the furrier to lend them the boy to take a message to Machecoul, and when Jeudon did not return, the two noblemen told the inquiring furrier that they were ignorant of the boy's whereabouts and suggested he had been carried off by thieves to be made into a page. At Drey's trial, the events were attested to by Hilliare and his wife, the boy's father Jean Jeudon, and five others from Machecoul. So there's a 1971 biography of Drey that came out by an author named Jean Benedetti, who tells how the children who fell into Drey's hands were put to death. So according to this biographer, the boy was pampered and dressed in better clothes than he had ever known. The evening began with a large meal and heavy drinking, particularly hypocras, which acted as a stimulant. The boy was then taken to an upper room, to which only Gilles and his immediate circle were admitted. There he was confronted with the true nature of his situation. The shock thus produced upon the boy was an initial source of pleasure for Gilles. Drey's body servant, Etienne Corillot, also known as Poitou, was an accomplice in many of the crimes and testified that his master stripped the child naked and hung him with ropes from a hook to prevent him from crying out, and then masturbated upon the child's belly or thighs. If the victim was a boy, he would touch his genitals, particularly the testicles and the buttocks. Taking the victim down, Drey comforted the child and assured him he only wanted to play with him. Drey then either killed the child himself or had the child killed by his cousin Gilles de Sille, Poitou, or another body servant called Henriet. The victims were killed by decapitation, cutting of their throats, dismemberment, or breaking their necks with a stick. A short, thick, double-edged sword was kept at hand for the murders also. Poitou further testified that Drey sometimes abused the victims, whether boys or girls, before wounding them and at other times after the victim had been slashed in the throat or decapitated. According to Poitou, Drey disdained the victim's sexual organs and took infinitely more pleasure in debauching himself in this manner than in using their natural orifice in the normal manner. In his own confession, Guilderoy testified that when the said children were dead, he kissed them, and those who had the most handsome limbs and heads he held up to admire them, and had their bodies cruelly cut open and took delight at the sight of their inner organs, and very often, when the children were dying, he sat on their stomachs and took pleasure in seeing them die, and laughed. Poitou testified that he and Henriet burned the bodies in the fireplace in Drey's room. The clothes of the victims were placed in the fire piece by piece, so they burned slowly and the smell was minimized. The ashes were then thrown into the cesspit, the moat, or other hiding places. The last recorded murder was the son of Ionet de Villeblanche and his wife Massy. Poitou paid 20 sous to have a page's doublet made for the victim, who was then assaulted, murdered, and incinerated in August of 1440. So we can take a breather.
I'm so mad, and now I can see exactly why, like, the Beast of Dre, like, I can see the fucking correlation. Mm-hmm. What an idol to have.
Hero worship, am I right? So,
makes me kind of wonder about Joan of Arc a little bit.
Right.
I mean, we should all be wondering about Joan of Arc, but it makes me wonder about some things I didn't initially wonder about her.
Well, I will say put a pin in your thoughts. But that's valid. So you can imagine with a confession like that, there's like no way this guy was gonna get out scot-free. Like, he was gonna be punished.
I don't know. These days I can imagine a lot of things.
That's fair. The two servants who confessed were sentenced to death and were burned at the stake. Deray was slated for the same punishment, although after he died, his body was cut down before the flames consumed it, and he was buried in a graveyard. I think, like, his last request was, I want to be buried in this place, so they honored his final request by having him buried somewhere specific. It's said at his execution, he spoke to the crowd with piety and urged his servants to die bravely and only think of salvation. And that's that. Deray died. His family changed the spelling of their name various times to distance themselves from him, and his actions went down in history, especially being the supposed inspiration for the legend of Bluebeard, which, quite frankly, I don't get, because I thought Bluebeard, I thought he killed his wives, not little boys, but I saw that multiple times, so I don't really get how you get from A to B, but...
I'm not a Bluebeard expert.
Here's where, you know, there's a little bit of, historical conflict. So, now, in the modern days, and by modern days I mean the last 25 to 30 years, the question of his innocence has been kind of debated. So, those who maintain Deray's guilt hold to the many detailed eyewitness accounts given at his trial, including those of his own confederates. However, there are counter-arguments based on the fact that there's a theory that Deray was himself a victim of an ecclesiastical plot or act of revenge by the Catholic Church or the French state. Doubts about his guilt have actually been around basically since he died, but there's not been a way to, like, there were, like, pamphlets in, like, the 1920s in France talking about, like, this guy was set up. But because these are, like, handmade pamphlets and things don't really circulate that well, like, now in, like, a modern age where we have infinitely better printing and access to the internet, things are able to spread a little bit more. And it's said that even Charles VII didn't really believe that he was guilty of the things that he was accused of. But doubts about his guilt have long persisted because the Duke of Brittany, who was given the authority to prosecute, received all the titles to Deray's former lands after he was convicted. So, if you go back and think about how the King of France said he can't sell any more of his land, and if you've already bought some of his land, you can't sell it off either.
Right.
But the Duke of Brittany was like, I'm not gonna get involved in that. Now, he stands to inherit a lot of land and benefit quite a bit by Deray's death, which...
I see where the Bathory vibes are coming in. Yes. I see it. I don't want to go into detail on that. One day I will.
Yes. So, and after he died, after he was convicted, the Duke did absolutely that. He divided the land up among his favorites and his nobles. There are writers such as secret society specialist Jean-Pierre Bayard, who wrote a book called Plaidoyer pour Gilles Deray. I'm sure I really mispronounced that first word. But they think that he was a victim of the Inquisition. And a really big voice right now that is really active in, like saying that he's innocent, is an English writer named Margot K. Juby. She fairly recently published a book called The Martyrdom of Gilles Deray that's cites the torture that the ecclesiastical court used in obtaining his confession, as well as the lack of any physical evidence presented at the time of the event, of the over 100 murders he's said to have committed. She says, quote, "It seems impossibly quaint in the 21st century to read a text that fully accepts the validity of an Inquisition trial with the use of torture," in reference to modern scholarship that asserts his guilt. In fact, Juby may be the most adamant voice in crying his innocence and may well be the best hope, if he's innocent, of undoing centuries of, like, villainy attributed to his name. She says, "I'm still finding things that are cited as fact in all the biographies that turned out to be based on dust and moonlight. An example is the murder of three children by Deray's valet Henriet, Henriet, which appears in two earlier biographies. Juby looked through trial records and even checked the Latin transcript and found nothing about these three children. Bossard, one of the earliest biographers, seems to have made it up, she says. And then another biographer who came around later, named with the last name Bataille, swallowed Bossard's story whole without ever looking it up for himself, and it has just continued to get passed on through every biography of this person's life, basically, till today. So there's a lot of evidence that a lot of people who wrote books that are considered expert, like historically based books about his life, it seems like those people may never have actually done any research on their own and were just relying on other people's works.
That is literally just how it goes, though. Like, doesn't it just make you question every historical story you've ever heard?
Yeah. And, like, I won't get into it here, but she talks about how, like, this biographer wrote this, and then you can almost follow it. And then this person, like, recounted the story in this book, but then he added a little bit of detail. And then that detail suddenly shows up in the next biography.
It's a big fish story.
Exactly. And it just gets, and then at one point, somebody wrote a novel, a fictional novel, and that was reinterpreted as nonfiction by somebody else. So,
can you imagine if Bataille had that happen? There are so many, like, weird sex novels about her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's, so,
like, imagine if Hostel 2 was just fact.
What Juppé ends up calling the case of Gilderay is a posthumous public relations disaster. And she continues to press again that there was absolutely no evidence of any kind, which is supremely unlikely for how many victims were supposed to have been. She asks, what did they find, unearth, or discover during their exploration? And then another biographer, who also believes in the innocence of Deray, says there is nothing, not a clue, not a tooth, not a trace, not a hair, not one witness who can definitively say, I have seen, not a weeping mother who claims, there is the dress, stained with the blood of my dead daughter, not a father who brings a child's heart ripped from its chest and wrapped in a spotted cloth. And in 1992, Gilderay was retried during a media event in France without any official involvement of public authorities in the judicial body. And in fact, one of the people, The court that tried him consisted of former French ministers, parliament members, and UNESCO experts that re-examined the source materials and evidence that was available at the medieval trial, so, like, when he was actually a trial. A team of lawyers, writers, and politicians led by Gilbert Pruteau, who is one of the biographers, modern biographers, and it was presided over by Judge Henri Jérémy, found Gilderay not guilty. Although people who really cling to his historical guilt like to point out that none of those people are medieval historians by profession. And that nobody in that trial sought professional advice from certified medievalists. So right now there are two camps. There are people who think he fucking ruined a bunch of children and is a huge monster. And other people who think he, like, didn't and was used to gain his lands, basically. And it kind of seems to be a straight-up divide between people who want to see, like, evidence and facts and people that are historians that want to follow, like, a document trail, even though the document trail has proven to be maybe a little... Yeah. So that is the controversial history of Gilderay.
That was so interesting. I learned a thing today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I totally see where the Beast of Jersey got it from, but man, if he knew our, like, modern conceptions of it, where we think maybe he's totally, potentially guilty of all these horrendous acts against children, maybe, I'm not saying he is, but maybe, then yeah, he would be, like, probably really sad, because he'd use that to justify a lot of his own, like, horrific things.
Yeah, but I feel like he would have found anything to justify.
That's true. I thought it was interesting, and this is just me postulating, But when way, way back at the beginning of the story, when I talked about how Guilderoy's grandfather was, like, a big social climber, and he tried to, like, marry him off to different heiresses, one of the earliest ones that his grandfather tried to marry him off to was a woman with the surname or family name of Peynel.
Oh, damn.
It's spelled a little bit differently, but and I wonder if he knew about that fact, or if he... maybe he thinks he's, like, the unborn fate child of what would have been Guilderoy if he had married this woman. I don't know. It's weird.
It's a lot to unpack. That was extremely interesting. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, even if I had heard of him, I never would have heard, like, the thought that it might entirely be... He might entirely be framed for the benefit of others.
Yeah.
Well,
we may never know for sure, but it definitely bears considering.
Right. Also, like, in those kind of cases, like Bathory, whenever they do, like, frame somebody, they really go hard, don't they?
They really do. That's the thing. It's like, people who, like, the first time, and again, I keep talking about this as if everyone knows about it, but really the reason I'm not going into more detail about it is because I hope that maybe at some point in the future, Kim will do an episode about it and you guys can get it from her. But I assume most people have in some way or another heard of Elizabeth Bathory or Elizabeth Bathory.
Bathory or Bathory.
And she's, you know, kind of, if you've heard of her, she's kind of the woman who, like, bathes in virgin blood to keep her skin looking young and beautiful, and she's
the most prolific female serial killer of all time.
And, you know, she's also said to have killed hundreds and hundreds of young girls, and it's a very similar kind of case, and it's the kind of thing, the first time I hear about her crimes or the way that his crimes are described, they're just absolutely the most, like, despicable things.
Like, right. It's, like, crazy. Like, they could have just literally been like, she killed 5 girls.
And people, yeah.
And they would have been like, oh, that's suspicious. But he's like, nah, she killed 600.
She killed 500 girls. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, 5's not good enough. Add a couple zeros to the end there. And
But yeah, I do plan on doing that. I'm actually in the... I've written a couple academic papers on her, but I don't have them anymore because when I dropped out of college, I was just like, delete everything. But I am re-researching it now so that I can do a solid episode on her because her story is something that I'm very passionate about.
I look forward to your coverage on it. Do you have, I guess we should probably wrap it up. Do you have anything you want to add here? I think we...
Nope.
We got a couple of things we teased at the beginning that we got to throw in.
Yeah. We have a new sponsor.
We have a sponsor.
And they are called Grinding Coffee Company. They are a Black and LGBT-owned coffee company. They like to sponsor other people who are minorities and under the LGBT umbrella.
They like to focus on, like, women and small content creators, too, which I think is really awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're really big in, like, I was gonna say they're big into the Twitch community, which is
they mostly do that.
Yeah.
But the best thing about it is that their coffee is really good.
It is absolutely verified, 100%. I've been drinking it. It's awesome.
It's like a nice luxury coffee. So if you want to treat yourself during this quarantine time, you can use our promo code, which is 13club. It's the XIII club. And you can use that at grindingcoffee.co.
And you will get 13% off your purchase if you do that.
Should have mentioned that. That was kind of a big part. We're going to get it. We're going to do an ad read, and then you guys are going to be sick of it.
Yeah. But for right now...
But we're excited right now.
You have to live with us in the moment, sharing our joy with you, ad-libbing it.
Yeah.
They've got, like... I was going to just say, like, as an aside, like, to, like, just talk about how hyped I am about it. Like, they have, like... lots of, like, country, like, different country origins. They've got, like, flavored stuff. They've got cold brew. They've even got, like, a small collection of, like, K-cups. So there's, like, whatever you like, they've got something for you, I promise.
Yep, I ordered the cold brew one. I'm waiting on it, and I am excited to make it.
Hell yeah.
And then if you want to get a hold of us, find our social media, find our email address, find anything like that, you can find it at 13club.com, which is XIIIclub.com.
Another great thing you can find on our website are all the resources we used when we were researching our topics today. So if you want to look into either of these things for yourself, like if you want to look into that, like, poor fire fairy girl and, like, see how she was exploited, or if you want to look more into the competing theories about Guilleray's innocence or lack thereof, we're going to have a ton of great sources up on the website as well.
But we will not be linking the Daily Mail.
No. You can go search that one out yourself if you dare.
Please don't.
Don't tell us if you did. Don't tell us if you
did. I would not lead you wrong about this.
I'm just saying, if you look it up, don't tell us. So, or
just like, I don't know. I just don't want them to have trouble.
No, they don't deserve it.
All right, thanks, guys.
Bye, everybody.
We'll see you next week.